So these tribes became like guaranteed taxpayer-supported markets for corporate products and services. A lot of these programs that were sold under the pretext of helping the poor were just really a strategy for the elites to redistribute the wealth from the middle class under the pretext of helping the poor. And you know, those policies in turn were projected out into the United States, costing the taxpayers billions upon billions of dollars. So the money that was generated from the casinos was used to finance the mergers and acquisitions departments of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. They could acquire contracts of an unlimited monetary amount, and regardless of how wealthy they became, they would always be classified as disadvantaged. The major defense contractors like McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and so forth were able to work behind them using the Alaska Native corporations as front groups and then acquire these lucrative contracts through the back doors of the Indian tribes.
With the global economy being in shambles and central bankers moving towards a reset, it's never been a better time to protect your wealth by owning precious metals. Silver is at historical lows, and that's the best time to buy. Contact Andy at milesfranklin.com. Tell him Sarah sent you. He promised me he will guarantee you the lowest price anywhere in the country. Remember, email Andy at milesfranklin.com and tell him Sarah sent you. It's never been a better time to protect your future than now. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This episode, I welcome Susan Bradford to the program. She was on before. She's just incredible. Her background and the research that she does, the information that you're going to get from her is not something you're going to get elsewhere. She has really impressive experience. She was a speechwriter for the England Shadow Secretary and also the speechwriter for the U.S.'s South Korean ambassador. She was a producer for both CBS and Fox News, and has authored many books on the deep state, which I highly recommend. And you can go to Amazon.com and get any one of her books. But today we're going to talk about how the British Crown, backed by the Rothschilds, the City of London, and Wall Street, used the Indian reservations to build up the deep state and swindle the United States Americans and the American Indians out of billions, probably trillions of dollars. We also discuss how the Crown's goal was to ultimately gain world dominance by weakening and taking control over the United States. They never got over losing the United States colony, and they wanted it back, and they used the Indian reservation as a tool to make that happen. Steal money, build up corporations that'll do their bidding, and you'll hear a lot more in this interview. But that plan is still in works today, and we're seeing it everywhere. The chaos on the streets, the fake coronavirus. It's not fake. I mean, people are dying, but everybody knows by now it's been way overblown. They're lying in the media. They're creating fear. It's just crap that we're having to deal with. But Susan Bradford also sticks around and does an exclusive for my patrons on how they use China and intelligence to build AIG into the largest insurance company in the world. You're going to want to see that. And that's for my patrons at patreon.com/Sarah Westall. But before we get into this interview, I want to let you know that Tetragen is now available on my website under Green Pill Living and under Tetragen at sarahwestall.com under shop. Many have been waiting for this to become available. I've been talking about it for the last couple shows, and we were having some issues with it, but it is now up and ready, and they have it in stock. And patrons, you save 20% when you buy ongoing, when you buy Tetragen, and new buyers for Green Pill Living will save 15%. So look for those coupons at sarahwestall.com/shop. And see how you can lose weight with Tetragen. And believe it or not, it's guaranteed to lose weight or you get your money back. You have 90 days. It takes some time to kick in. But I mean, what kind of deal do you get like that where you get your money back for a weight loss product? That's because this thing works. So give it a try. Again, sarahwestall.com under shop. Now let's get into this interview with Susan Bradford. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for inviting me back. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I really had to talk to you because, you know, the idea of the Indian tribal lands being used, reservations being used to build up the deep state is a pattern that I have been seeing over the years. And with all your research into it, it really made sense to talk to you about it. I mean, from the standpoint that I've been hearing that under Obama, they brought in over 100,000 Syrians on reservation. I have a really good source on that. And then I've been told by Tor, who was on my program just recently, who said if there's going to be a civil war, look to the Indian reservations because that's what they use. And then I had Kevin Annette tell me that the Chinese is putting their soldiers on Indian reservations. And, you know, I mean, I'm hearing it from all different directions. And then you were saying it. So now I got all these good sources telling me that there's something about Indian reservations. So I really thought it was time to talk about it. And so I so much appreciate it. But I wanted you to start with talking about the history of the creation of the tribes and what, you know, what kind of started this off where the deep state elite decided to use the tribal lands and reservations as a way to enrich themselves and gain power?
Okay, that's a very good question. And just to start from the beginning, after the American Revolution, the colonists were able to separate from Great Britain. And early on, one of our founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of State, tried to help the elites weasel their way back into our institutions by creating the first central bank. It was called the First Bank of the United States. And his colleagues got wind to his agenda and refused to renew the charter. So the British elites and their international bankers wanted to stake claim on our land and our incredible natural resources in uncharted territory. So as the colonists were moving westward, they armed the Indians to prevent expansion, as the Indians began to fight, you know, the new Americans, the Rothschilds came in and they offered to sponsor the colonists and to help the government fight back the Indians, and in so doing, they created debt, and that debt again pushed us back into the control of the Rothschilds because we were now indebted to them. After the War of 1812, the Rothschilds were invited to join the British and European aristocracy, and the symbol that they adopted and they patented was the five arrows wrapped in a bow, and each one of those arrows represented a Rothschild son who was to control a specific aspect of the world, and of course the greatest the greatest accomplishment or the greatest asset that they could claim was the United States. So now that they had an end to the United States, you know, they were trying to, you know, reclaim it, and they were going to reclaim it, they had planned, through the Indian tribes. Around the time of the Civil War, they were looking at basically tearing apart or dividing the country apart and staking claim on it, but they were blocked by the Russians. So that in turn that created a fissure between, you know, the Russian aristocrats who were the allies of our government and themselves, and that, you know, put a target on their backs, which they eventually, you know, addressed later on, making, you know, Russia an enemy to them. After the Civil War, I mean, they realized that, you know, they couldn't easily kind of weasel their way back into our government. And so they backed our robber barons, the most prominent of which was John D. Rockefeller. He was the son of a snake oil salesman. And he became the leading oil tycoon. He founded Standard Oil, which cornered 88% of the market by 1890 through strategies that he adopted, you know, with these European elites. He was funded and he collaborated with J.P. Morgan. He was a banker to our robber barons. J.P. Morgan was trained in London. By 1912, you know, these elites were beginning to consolidate control over our government and our financial system. So the House Banking and Currency Committee began to investigate them to try to, you know, to check what they were trying to do. By 1926, Nelson Rockefeller financed Baptist missionaries to essentially to corral them, or he sent them over to the various Indian tribes, which were already, you know, working with the European elites. They were under, you know, their control. He funded a group called the Indian Rights Association, worked behind them through Baptist missionaries to corral them onto land that was rich in oil and natural resources. So in order for them to kind of exploit the land and the natural resources, they had to have some type of legal or, you know, academic justification. So they sponsored a report at the Brookings Institution that gave them $125,000 to survey the problems in Indian country. And of course, on the board of director of Brookings were two Rockefeller attorneys and a Carnegie executive. And they produced a report called The Problems of Indian Administration. And they, of course, determined that the problems in Indian country had to do with the loss of Indian land, their desire to curtail expansion into the territory, you know, because the elites wanted that land, and, you know, a way for them to acquire their own assets. They then, once they had that, they released that report, a treasurer from the Indian Rights Association by the name of Charles Rhodes was then appointed to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who then addressed the problem. By 1932, there was a national banking crisis that was orchestrated by these elites that resulted in the closure of banks across the country. And at this point, the United States was declared bankrupt and insolvent. That led to Glass-Steagall, and Glass-Steagall tried to restore confidence in the banking industry through by separating commercial and investment banking. But it did something else too, and that was that it opened the ledgers of banks to a government inspection. Now, the elites did not want their own ledgers inspected, so they created federally recognized Indian tribes, which were sovereign nations and did not have to submit to FOIA reports or to, you know, to share their financial information. And the federally recognized Indian tribes were they were established as corporations that could receive money from the federal government. They could develop businesses that were tax-free. And the British had also ensured that in exchange for giving the government their land, they would be provided with housing, education, hospital care in perpetuity as Indians. So this was the beginning of the entitlement program.
One thing I saw in the book that you wrote is that it said that the tribes negotiated in exchange for their land, them being supplied all of this, but it didn't make sense because the tribes didn't even really see land as theirs. They didn't see it as anybody's at the time. So it was like they put that in place for them, and it wasn't the tribes didn't even demand it.
That's correct. I mean, the Indians didn't even have a concept of land ownership or any sense of a legal loss or any, you know, they didn't have any like a legal concept of land ownership, and they were essentially a vanquished people. So why would it wouldn't be in the interest of the federal government to give a vanquished people free money, especially after they had been declared bankrupt and insolvent? So it wasn't within the government's interest, but it was in the elite's interest.
Yeah. And this is what you talk about, is how they, once they could do these government programs and be in charge of all of these government programs, it became one big way to steal money and to control. So what were the programs they were in charge of again?
Okay, it was at the beginning. Now the programs are much more varied and sophisticated. But originally, they were provided with free health care, free medical care, and free education, which I think is reasonable for them. But after they established the Indian tribes, an Indian commissioner by the name of John Collier, who was an acolyte to J.P. Morgan. He was groomed by the international bankers. He received a $1,000 incentive from Rockefeller to help create these tribal entities through the Indian Reorganization Act. And he wrote in his book, his memoirs, From Every Zenith, that he wanted to transform Indian tribes into he wanted them to resemble communist China, which also had been created by these elites. And he wanted to create a type of European social democracy that would be created within Indian country and then projected into the wider United States. And what a European social democracy was, I mean, this was a type of social program that was created in England after World War II. And if you recall, during World War II, the multinationals and the elite corporations were able to make a deluge of money both before, during, and after the war by providing munitions, by providing all the staples during war. And then after the war, they were able to rebuild the countries also with government money. So they were becoming addicted to easy public funds. And a gentleman by the name of William Beveridge, who was a British economist, he developed the foundations and intellectual foundations for the modern welfare state and unemployment insurance and social security. And the idea was that if he could get the public or the government through public assets to fund like health care and different social programs, pension funds and so forth, which they ended up looting anyway, that you could take those liabilities off the corporate corporate ledgers and thereby increase the profitability of those corporations. Also, by providing the poor with guaranteed income and guaranteed support, they would then have assets that they could use, provided by the taxpayers, that they could use to buy goods and services that would also enrich, the elites by creating a demand for their products, and giving them the wherewithal to purchase them.
Well, taking over all their education was another means for them to. I know this is an awful thing to bring up, but I've had Kevin Annette on quite a bit, and by them taking over their education for 150 years since they started, they've been doing it for over 100 years. They brought in these little kids to these boarding schools, and like half of them would die. They wouldn't even make it out. They were trying to get them to conform to Western culture. And that was how they sold it. But they treated them so bad that it was ended up being a mass genocide. And half those kids didn't even make it out alive.
That's a very good point. I know that the originally the idea of the tribes was sold to the Indians on the grounds that they would be able to keep their indigenous societies and be protected from modern society. But the schools were intended to indoctrinate them into not even a Western way of thinking, but a British, they provided them with Anglo acculturation. So it was the education that the monarch wanted them to have. And not only were they treated terribly, but I mean, there are also reports of that a number, even now, that a lot of Indian children go missing, that they're taken away from their families, often, allegedly without grounds. They're placed into other families in a type of foster program, but then never heard from again.
And that comes back to the human trafficking. And the human trafficking, the Indian, the American Indian children more because they don't track it on the FBI stats. And they can get by with doing it because it doesn't affect our numbers. But that's the whole point, is they're doing all this stuff without affecting their numbers anywhere. It's all hidden.
It's all hidden. That's correct. After after the World Wars, I guess around 1944, the elites convened the tribal leaders to establish a Congress of American Indians, which essentially enabled them to, like, they were trying to figure out how can we exploit the tribes and to generate revenue from them. So one of the ways that they sought to generate revenue was by suing the federal government for land that the ancestors of the Indians had lost. So all the land that was taken, they were going to get compensation for that. And the compensation, the settlement money was sold to the government as it would be distributed to the tribal members in the form of checks. But what happened was by the time the settlements arrived, they dispatched attorneys to those tribal councils to ensure that the money was shored up in tribal council and then used as seed money to create casinos. And casinos were sold to the American Indians and to the government on grounds that if we have casinos, we'll no longer need to provide, the government will no longer need to provide for the Indians. They will be able to provide for themselves, and they'll have more than enough money for housing, medical care, and for anything else that they could possibly need for government infrastructure.
Well, it makes sense, right? That makes sense. But really what happened?
Yes, it does make sense. It was a compelling case. But what really happened is that, of course, the tribal council served as a middleman, for the energy, uranium and oil companies and for, corporate America and for multinationals. In many cases, the tribal council created joint bank accounts with the elites and was able to siphon money from the casinos into their hands. So a lot of the money disappeared through the back door. A lot of tribal members were given meager per capita payments, like guaranteed income, and it was just enough to keep them dependent, but it was more of a smokescreen that allowed them to continue to siphon money from the federal government. And they would always portray the Indians as being very poor. And if they were poor, they could then justify more expenditures from the federal government. And as time progressed, they were able to figure out they were able to create different demands for federal money. So they could, for example, decide that every tribe should have a windmill, and then the government might give $2 to $3 million per tribe for the windmills. They might decide that all the tribes now need to have solar paneling, on their roofs, and so they could then have expenditure for that. So these tribes became like guaranteed taxpayer-supported markets for corporate products and services. So they're a very lucrative market. And of course, with all of the money that they were generating from the casinos, they were able to pour more money back into the federal government to influence policy. And they could, give money to the universities to dictate, research, give money to the, to universities and in the media and so forth. And in turn, the elites were able to get, more control over those institutions.
There's also what you talked about was experimental social programs. And we talked about what they did with the schools, where they're trying to indoctrinate them and change them. And then these children, just half of them ended up not surviving. But they also were doing, for decades, I've had shows where they were putting chips in Indians. They were chipping them for decades, mapping their healthcare and their bank accounts to these chip devices, which they're talking about doing to all of us. But you're saying that they are doing other social programs as well. Can you talk about some of the social programs that they were doing with them on the reservations to later do to us?
Okay, absolutely. And I haven't heard anything about the chips. I'm sure, I expect it has happened. I haven't, read anything about that.
Yeah, I've done some shows on it. It's clear that they did it, but it's probably, there's so much to know, you're not going to know everything. But if somebody wants to know that, it's on my front page, and I have a show with the top source, and she's great. She's written a book about it, and you can learn all about it. But anyways, keep going.
So one strategy that they employed was in order to secure markets for themselves,
they would force tribal members to purchase life insurance. So the life insurance would be it would be required of the Indians to purchase. They would purchase the life insurance from their per capita payments, which were generated by the casinos, which were financed by the American taxpayer. So if the tribal member were to run up any debt they had not paid by the time of their death, the health insurance would cover the debt. So that ensured that the Indians would essentially be captive consumers for corporate goods. But a lot of very damaging social policies emanated from the tribes, including, for example, the S&Ls, socialized medicine, Section 8 housing, subprime mortgages. A lot of these programs that were sold under the pretext of helping the poor were just really a strategy for the elites to redistribute the wealth from the middle class under the pretext of helping the poor. So they were, they were essentially redistributing the wealth. And, those policies in turn were projected out into the United States, costing, the taxpayers billions upon billions of dollars.
And it was just a great vehicle to be able to skim a lot of money out of the United States into their pockets, do experiments, and also have control of the United States through them. Can you talk a little bit more about how they were able to use them to have control more of the United States? Besides, money is a big deal, but besides just siphoning off money through taxpayer funds, how else were they able to use the reservations for control?
Okay, that's a very good question. So the money that was generated from the casinos was used to finance the mergers and acquisitions departments of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And Goldman Sachs was the banker of Ford and the seven sisters of the Standard Oil companies, which were affiliated with Rockefeller. And Morgan Stanley was the banker of General Motors. So in 1986, when the casinos were beginning to arrive on the reservations, both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs simultaneously decided to break with from their traditions of being private companies, and they went public. And they were, at the time, they were anticipating a deluge of wealth. They said they couldn't determine exactly how much they were going to get, only that it would be ongoing, and that they were going to get billions upon billions of dollars. The money was coming from the Indian tribes vis-a-vis Sumitomo Bank in Japan. So they were able to finance the merger and acquisitions department, creating the entities that became too big to fail, and it also enabled both of those banks to dominate the market. So they were easily outpacing the competition. And then, of course, by 2008, during the subprime mortgage crisis, they had solidified their position, and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were the only two houses left standing by that point. And then another means through which they were able to acquire control was through the minerals and oil in Indian country. President Nixon once said that whoever controls all of the energy controls the nation. So in 1970, the Navajo chairman Peter McDonald, with the advice and encouragement of the elite, founded a group called CERT, which is a Council of Energy Resource Tribes, in an effort to create an OPEC, like a cartel type of situation, within America's borders. These Indians, took advice from OPEC leaders on how to set this up. And CERT controlled, billions of dollars worth of uranium, oil, coal within Indian country. And this allowed the elites to siphon that energy. And just to give you an example, Peabody Energy, which is a major international brokerage house for coal that has offices in the United States, Great Britain, Australia, China, paid
the Navajo 4.2 million to develop and exploit its extract its coal. Peabody then turned around and sold that coal for $141 million on the market. So they made a huge profit, of course, and of course the extraction was subsidized by the taxpayer, so they invested very little. They made a fortune, and of course the Indian tribe was given a few pennies on the dollar for the trouble.
And that's what they do, right? I mean, they pay them almost nothing. They make a fortune. They use the people, the tax money to pay for it. They use the Indians as the patsy to get a little bit, and then they take all of the profit.
That's correct. That's correct. And this also ties into the creation of the Carlyle Group, which became a major player in the deep state. Around 1968, Atlantic Richfield discovered oil in Prudhon Bay in Alaska. But before they could extract the oil, they had to resolve the issue of the title of the land title or title to land in Alaska. So they arranged the a settlement for them. It was called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement, which provided $1 billion, close to $1 billion to the Indians, most of which disappeared into private hands. But the little that was left was used to create Alaska Native corporations and Native villages. And these were intended to help the Indians have some level of economic self-sufficiency so they wouldn't have to rely upon the federal government. But initially, they set up a tax scam. It was where they would companies would, and I can kind of explain how it works and how Carlyle took advantage of it. It was called the Great Eskimo tax scam. They the ANCs would, for example, they'd mine timber that might cost $100 to acquire timber on an acre of land, for example. But they would sell that timber for a dollar. So they would then record $99 in losses on their tax records. Carlyle would then buy that loss for $50, and then they would sell the loss they would actually have $99 worth of losses that they would then sell for $49, enabling a corporation to have maybe $51 of tax credits. So it was like the carbon, the carbon tax where you could sell credits. Carlyle was built on that tax scam, enabling them to acquire $1 billion, or to actually deny the taxpayers $1 billion of revenue. And then Carlyle went on to become a major defense contractor. And that was due to different, Senator Ted Stevens helped set up minority preference rules for the Alaska Native corporations that enabled them to acquire non-compete contracts, which means that they were guaranteed the contracts without having to go through the normal channels of competitive bidding. They could acquire contracts of an unlimited monetary amount, and regardless of how wealthy they became, they would always be classified as disadvantaged. The major defense contractors like McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and so forth were able to work behind them using the Alaska Native corporations as front groups and then acquire these lucrative contracts through the back doors of the Indian tribes.
You know, when you see that they put themselves as disadvantaged and then that gives them all these benefits, do you see that starting to happen in today where they're trying to set up certain groups to be disadvantaged so they can do massive swindles?
Yes, and that's a very good question. The Rockefellers through the decades had worked with a lot of African-American groups, and they would demand that that the taxpayer pay billions of dollars in reparations,
and of course, you know, for slavery, for example, and the money would then be used to create African American radio stations and TV stations and other like radical groups that would then be used not to advantage the African American, but to incite, you know, racial dissent within American borders. So it was used as like a revolutionary strategy.
That's what it seems like is happening to a degree right now, where they're using certain groups to do that, and all these companies are supporting it. But one thing you also talked about is the creating entities that are too big to fail. How does that tie into the Indian reservations?
One of them, you know, was AIG, which I'll get into a little later, but they're able to create these entities. Like, for example, with General Motors, General Motors became one of the largest employers in the United States. So it created cars, it created car parts, it created just so many different types of devices, different product lines, different service lines, that if General Motors were to go under, and it was, you know, becoming, it has overextended itself on numerous occasions. If General Motors would go under, then all of those, you know, millions of employees would lose their jobs. And so they could make the case that, look, if you want to save the economy, you've got to bail us out.
That's what they've done with all these banks and so forth. How, and so did they tie, well, I mean, how do you tie that into the Indian reservations? Meaning they use the Indian reservation to build up that company to that point?
Correct. So they were able to capitalize on the cash that they were able to extract from the casinos and other tribal businesses. General Motors was one of the leading sponsors of Native businesses, and that's because they're able to, like, they have a stake in many of them. You know, if they were left to their own devices in the market, in the marketplace, you know, they would not hold the dominant market position that they've had.
Well, I'm not surprised about that. It's like so many companies that you see that are up there, fewer there because they did it organically, and it's more because they were supported by some kind of government deal. Let's go through the military industrial complex, because I think that gets into what's some of the things that I'm concerned about, some of the comments that if there's a civil war that would look to the Indian reservations. So I want to know, what are they doing from the military industrial complex to build up using Indian reservations?